Good afternoon and welcome to House Labor and Commerce. It is 3:17 p.m. on Monday, April 2nd. Happy April. It is, members present, Representative Sullivan Leonard, Representative Stutes, Representative Knopf, Representative Birch, Representative Josephson, Vice Chair Willem, myself, Chair Keto. We do have a full committee and a quorum to conduct business. Please remember to turn your cell phones off, and if you need to take a call, do so out in the hallway. Today we have three items coming before the committee. We will not be hearing House Bill 230. We still have some additional information that we are waiting to receive on that. So our first bill is Senate Bill 155. Then we have real estate appraisal management companies. It'll be the second hearing on that bill, and Senate Bill 108, medical care licensing, medical board first hearing, House Bill 136, motor vehicle dealer franchises first hearing. And if we don't quite get through all of that, I do have another commitment and will be departing at about 4:20 or so, and we'll turn the gavel over to our capable vice chair unless we're done by then. So first up, we have Senate Bill 155, real estate management companies. If we can have Senator Meyer and Ms. Morledge come forward, place your name and affiliation on the record.
Thank you, Chair Keto, and members of the Judiciary or Labor and Commerce Committee, excuse me. And also, Mr. Chairman, I will have to leave at 4:15 to run the Resource Committee meeting, so if hopefully you'll excuse me if we're still here at that time. So for the record, my name is Senator Kevin Meyer, and I represent the Senate District M, which is the southeast part of Anchorage. And, Mr. Chair, it has come to my attention earlier this session that the federal government has imposed a deadline of August 10th this year for states to implement comprehensive legislation for the regulation of appraisal management companies. And you're probably wondering what is an appraisal management company. And they are independent entities through which mortgage lenders order residential real estate valuation services. These companies fulfill administrative function in the appraisal process, including selecting an appraiser and then delivering that appraiser to the lender. And, Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 155 basically does two things. It requires the regulation of the appraisal management companies, or referred to as AMCs, by the Board of Certified Real Estate Appraisers, including establishing minimum standards in accordance with the federal Dodd-Frank Act. And second, it establishes an annual registry fee for AMCs to be collected and transmitted to the Federal Appraisal Subcommittee on an annual basis to support the maintenance of the National Registry. While normally I'm not in favor of more regulation, but if we don't pass this legislation, the AMCs would be prohibited from providing appraisal services that involve federally related transactions in Alaska. And I think there are some people who are experts in this field if you have questions on what some of those transactions may be. And this would pose an economic hardship to Alaskans that are in the market to purchase or sell their homes. It is likely lending institutions would be inclined to shy away from using AMCs that cannot deal with the federal related transactions. By regulating the AMCs in the state, it offers consumers a wide range of options in obtaining appraisal services. And currently, Alaska is only one of four that does not currently have such a law in place. And the other three are like Alaska. They're in the process of passing their own legislation during this legislative cycle. Senate Bill 155 establishes the framework for the Department of Commerce, Community Economic Development to regulate the appraisal management companies and establishes minimum standards, including requiring the AMC designate a controlling person as the main point of contact to the board, who must be actively certified as a real estate appraiser. And second, requires appraisers working with AMCs to comply with uniform standards of professional appraisal practice and to meet all the professional legal standards to conduct appraisals in Alaska. And third, it requires a surety bond of $50,000. And what we found is the states vary on the surety bond, but $50,000 seemed to be on the high side and kind of the average of the mean and the highest. Due to the impending federal deadline, the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development has formally requested a one-year waiver since August 10th is coming up here quickly. They've requested this waiver from the Federal Appraisal Subcommittee. And our version of the bill that passed the Senate and is over here recognized the deadline of August 10th and the fact that it was coming up soon, and we weren't sure whether we were going to get the deadline or not. We had some contingency language in the case that we weren't able to get that one-year waiver. The version that's before us now, I think, is the version in front of the committee, version R. It established a firm effective date of January 1, 2019 as the registration deadline and a registration deadline of March 1st, 2019. So that basically is a summary, Mr. Chair. Thank you for hearing the bill, and that concludes my comments.
Thank you, Senator Meyer. We've got a question from Representative Stutes.
Thank you. Through the chair, good afternoon, Senator Meyer. I do have a question. There's some confusion as to whether or not if the state of Alaska does not enact this bill, they will be eligible to receive Freddie Mac, Fannie Mae, and FHA loans. Is that overall or is that in particular?
Through the chair, Representative Stutes, there is some concern, and I think it does impact some of those loans that deal with Freddie Mae, Freddie Mac. But again, I think I would like to have some of the experts that I think are online answer that question more precisely.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? I think what we'll do is go ahead and get the committee substitute adopted. So the only difference between the bill that we originally heard and the committee substitute we have right now is we've updated the effective date. So what I would do is ask Representative Wool to make a motion to adopt the committee substitute.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that the committee adopt the work draft for SB 155 version 30-LS1295/R as the working document.
Okay. Thank you. And with that explanation of just changing the effective date, is there any objection to working with version R as our working document? Seeing none, version R is our working document. And we do have some people signed up for invited testimony and questions. And I think what we'll do first is go to David Derry, Chair of the Alaska Board of Real Estate Appraisers. Mr. Derry, can you place your name and affiliation on the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is David Derry. I'm serving as the Chair of the Alaska Board of Certified Real Estate Appraisers. I'm calling in to, again, voice our support as the Alaska Board of Certified Real Estate Appraisers for Senate Bill 155. We have testified at every opportunity in support of enacting AMC legislation. We think it's a key to having the maximum available mortgage sources for the residents of Alaska, and also it provides a basis for oversight of those AMCs operating in Alaska, and it meshes with our certified appraisers in the state of Alaska. So we support the bill. We have one point that we would request that be changed, and that references to page 5, line 25. This relates to the controlling person. Under the bill, as it's currently written, the controlling person is effectively the designated responsible party or contact for the board to the AMC, and the way the bill is currently written, that contact or that controlling person is identified as being a state-certified real estate appraiser in any state. We are requesting that that be changed to read a certified appraiser in the state of Alaska. The bill, as it was originally drafted and we originally looked at it, was written with that language, and then it was changed as a process through the Senate. I have previously sent to each of the House members an email with some points that we have regarding why we think it's important that that person, controlling person, be a Alaska certified appraiser, and the process to doing that. Objection to changing to that that I've heard is that other states don't make that requirement, and there's only apparently one state in the nation that actually has a requirement that the controlling person be certified in the state where that AMC is actually registered. And my response to that would be that what other states have done is probably related more to when those AMCs or when the states enacted AMC oversight and legislation and some of the issues and problems that those states have had with AMCs and lenders. In Alaska, we've been fortunate that when the big subprime mortgage market meltdown happened, 2007 to 2010, we in Alaska were not really hit with that. We had a strong economy at the time. Our lenders were doing a responsible job, and so we didn't really have the problems. Other states did have some tremendous problems, and as a result of that, you know, some lenders had some serious legal actions brought against them. Some appraisers did too, but we didn't have that. I think that's probably one of the reasons that we have not had AMC legislation enacted here to date, although the Alaska chapter of the Appraisal Institute did request and did try to get AMC legislation enacted back in 2014, 2015, and couldn't find anyone to sponsor that legislation, so it didn't go forward. But again, you know, we support that. I outlined in the email I sent to each of you members of the Labor and Commerce Committee what our position was for the controlling person, and not to regurgitate all that information again, but just one of the primary points that we have is we think geographic competency is particularly important in Alaska because of our diversity of locations. And geographic competency essentially just means that that appraiser and that AMC are jointly responsible for making sure the AMC is responsible for making sure that that appraiser they hire and send out to do an appraisal job is knowledgeable about the location they're going to. And I guess about the best parallel I can draw to that, the difference between being a state-certified appraiser in any state versus being a state-certified appraiser in Alaska is simply a situation where you're building a house and you need a plumber. So you hire a plumber that's licensed in Florida, and he's going to go do the plumbing of your house in Fairbanks. Well, I would hope that maybe that plumber has a little knowledge about the Fairbanks markets, from that Fairbanks climate, and the same is true from the appraiser standpoint.
Thank you, Mr. Derry. Do we have any questions for Mr. Derry? A question from Representative Josephson.
Yes, through the chair. Mr. Derry, do you have any knowledge about whether the federal subcommittee has any concern about your preference that the designated controlling person be in Alaska?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, interestingly enough, the controlling person or the term controlling person is not even addressed in federal regulations or federal oversight that we would be subject to. It addresses ownership only. So from that standpoint, no, there is no preference expressed about that controlling person.
Follow up.
Thank you. So, Mr. Derry, what I think I hear you saying is that because of the way the regulations are written, the subcommittee couldn't take a position on this in any case. Is that right?
Through the chair, that's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony, Mr. Derry. Next in invited testimony, we also have a Mark Shipman. Mr. Shipman, if you can place your name and affiliation on the record and provide us with your testimony, please.
Good afternoon. My name is Mark Shipman. I represent REBA, Trade Association Representing Appraisal Management Companies. I'm calling today from Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Schisman. If you can place or provide us with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'll be brief. REBA is strongly supportive of this legislation. We've led similar efforts across the country. We appreciate everybody's involvement in putting together a good piece of legislation. Where we only place where we differ is with Mr. Derry's request on the controlling person. We do not believe that there is a uniqueness to Alaska that requires this be different than in the other states. We do want to underscore our absolute desire to work with Mr. Derry and the appraisal board along with the legislature to be as compliant, good corporate citizens in working with the state. Beyond that, we are supportive and appreciate everybody's time.
Thank you, Mr. Schisman. Do we have any questions? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. We also have the department available. Ms. Chambers, did you want to provide testimony on the bill or just be available for questions? Questions? Does anybody have any questions for the department?
I do.
Representative Bull has a question, so
thank you, Mr.
Chair. Come
forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Sarah Chambers. I'm the Deputy Director of the Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing.
Thank you. And Representative Wool, go
ahead.
Thank
you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Chambers, for coming forward. It says this position would require hiring an extra person, but this position's cost would be spread among those programs. In other words, this job in itself isn't enough for a full-time position, but there's other tasks of other programs that, and you know what those programs are already, I take it?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, yes. We have absorbed several new licensing programs and expansions to licensing programs in the last few years and are at capacity. So we would need to hire another staff member, but don't anticipate all of these costs being borne by this program. 100% of our division is funded through licensing fees, so the portion of time that this person would spend on real estate appraisers would be charged in 15-minute increments to this program. But if they were to work half-time or third-time on another licensing program, that program would be charged and their licensing fees would cover that cost. Okay. This is just an expansion of authority so we can have enough expenditure authority to be able to spend that money.
Okay.
Well, no, that's about it. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Chambers. Seeing no other questions, thank you. Public testimony is not open on Senate Bill 155, although we have had public testimony on the House version of the bill. And so what I am going to do is go ahead and open up public testimony at 3:35 p.m. and make the dais available for anybody who would like to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 155. I don't have anyone signed up. Seeing no one in the room, we will close public testimony at 3:36 p.m. That brings the bill back before committee. Representative Stutes.
Thank you. Through the chair, I don't know if there's somebody online that can answer my question that I asked Senator Meyer, which is, by not enacting this legislation, does that prohibit all institutions from giving Freddie Mac, Fannie Mae, and FHA loans, or only certain institutions or no institutions from providing those federal funds for loans to Alaskans?
Perhaps if Mr. Derry, if you're still available online, would that be a question you might be able to answer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I can address that question. And Representative Stutes, the way this is actually structured is if we did not enact AMC legislation, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac loans could still be done in Alaska by virtually any lender. The difference would be if we did not enact AMC legislation, then it becomes fuzzy regarding any lender that actually uses an AMC or an appraisal management company. So, for example, First National Bank Anchorage, First National Bank Alaska, and Northwind Bank do not use AMCs. Some other lenders do use AMCs. Primarily, it's going to be either statewide or national lenders, and some of the lower 48 lenders that are active in the state of Alaska that use AMCs, and for good reason. So those would have some complications of handling federally related transactions. So that's really the difference, and it just comes down to the question of having the broadest possible availability of mortgage financing for the Alaska public, and that's one of the reasons that we are, of course, in favor of enacting AMC legislation is for that standpoint. And also from a selfish standpoint, as appraisers, we want to have the maximum available client pool that we can, too, so the AMCs provide that.
Follow up,
please. Thank you. Through the chair. So I heard your answer, but I don't know that it was specific enough for me. Does this prohibit certain lending institutes from lending Freddie Mac, Fannie Mae, and FHA funds to buyers?
Through the chair, Representative Stutes, the answer would be if we did not enact AMC legislation, it becomes a little bit of a fuzzy point. The question is, what is a federally regulated transaction or a federally related transaction? An AMC cannot operate in the state of Alaska for federally related transactions if we do not have AMC legislation. Then the question becomes, does a Fannie Mae loan or a Freddie Mac loan fall under a federally related transaction? And the question, or excuse me, the answer to that is likely not. So what would happen is if we did not have AMC legislation and some lender working through an AMC wanted to originate a Fannie Mae loan, they could do that. It would not prohibit them from doing that.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions? Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Derry, I just want to understand something you said. Some banks don't use AMCs and some do, and it sounded like those that don't use AMCs wouldn't be affected if this bill didn't pass, and you mentioned Northrim and some other banks. So it's totally up to the bank whether they use an AMC or not, and are appraisers such as those under your board, can they work independently and for AMCs simultaneously? So you could take a job for a bank that doesn't use an AMC or for one that does equally?
To the chair, Representative Wu, that's exactly right. The lenders are not obligated to use AMCs. It's probably more of a matter of convenience. And as I mentioned, it's probably more often used by the lower 48 lenders. And from the appraisal side, certainly there's no obligation that an appraiser in Alaska would sign up with an AMC to do appraisal work or serve as an independent appraiser, or they could do both. And some appraisers have opted that up to this time where they may decide they don't want to work with a specific AMC or a particular AMC. Some of them work with as many AMCs as possible, plus work as an independent appraiser.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Derry. The bill is back before committee now, and we do have amendments before us. So, Representative Josephson, do you want to offer your first amendment?
Yes. I move amendment number one, R1.
Okay, and I will object for discussion, Representative Josephson.
Mr. Chair, I'd invite my staff, Mr. Atkinson, to come forward and speak to this amendment. But the essence of this is that it would do, I believe, what Mr. Derry recommended, and I think contrary to some testimony we heard, but consistent with Mr. Derry, there are unique features of Alaska that would recommend that we have a person in state. And we heard that the subcommittee, which reflects the federal law effectively, has no disapproval because it's not spoken to in the regulations in any event. And that's why I'm making this motion.
Mr. Atkinson, can you place your name and affiliation on the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tom Atkinson, staff to Representative Andy Josephson. And I think that Mr. Derry has already done a good job of arguing why the board is arguing for this amendment. For it's as well established, there are no homegrown AMCs. There are no Alaska-grown AMCs. They're all outside corporations. So, but all your appraisers, or the vast majority of the appraisers that operate within Alaska, are small business people in Alaska. And we're suggesting that we support the small business people in Alaska as opposed to the outside corporations.
So I've got a question, Mr. Atkinson. So if we adopt this amendment and we still do not have any appraisal management companies in Alaska, and there is a lender that has an appraisal management company that doesn't have a controlling person residing in Alaska, are they prohibited from doing business in Alaska?
I actually didn't follow your question, Mr. Chairman.
So if we pass this amendment, we're requiring that an appraisal management company be controlled by an Alaska person. There are organizations that have appraisal management companies outside of the state of Alaska. And if they are affiliated with a lender that would like to lend in Alaska, will this provision prohibit them from using their appraisal management company to lend in Alaska?
No, it wouldn't, Mr. Chairman. The we wouldn't be requiring that the controlling person live in Alaska. We'd be requiring that the controlling person be certified to as an appraiser in Alaska. And it could be done through reciprocity. It could be a person from Virginia who's who lives in Virginia, say, who's a certified real estate appraiser there. And in order to become certified real estate appraiser in Alaska and thus qualify under this amendment, they'd have to apply to the board.
So if they are working on a follow-up question from myself, I guess, if they are working on a lending project, and their appraiser does not meet the requirements of Alaska licensure, then that lending project has to wait until that individual has received that licensure?
Mr. Chairman, I think the answer is yes. You'd be well advised to check with Ms. Chambers and Mr. Derry on that, but I believe your answer would be yes.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Atkinson? I would like to bring Ms. Chambers up. Thank you, Ms. Chambers, and again for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, for the record, Sarah Chambers, Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing.
Okay, thank you. And I guess maybe I'll try and rephrase the question. So if we pass this amendment, I want to make sure that we are not prohibiting people from doing work here that might allow them to do, I guess, bridge that gap that we have to go to federal lending. Will this impede the ability of the state to authorize or allow appraisers to be able to provide services in the state of Alaska, or will the department be able to accommodate the requests for licensure of companies that are not, don't have a controlling person or a identified person in the state?
Mr. Chairman, unfortunately, there are multiple points along the way because there are a lot of moving parts with a real estate appraisal and the federal oversight. I'll try to boil it down. The bill and what the amendment would do is require the controlling person, who is really a as Representative Josephson mentioned, is not involved with the federal appraisal part of it, but is really the person the board would work with, the person who's sort of up the food chain, if you will, in a management role in the AMC, to have some understanding and awareness of Alaska, because that person is going to, as the bill defines, in the definition section of controlling person, that person will have decision-making authority over policies and procedures having to do with those appraisals. They they engage with. That person may or may not be the boots on the ground appraiser. So at any rate, under any circumstance, the person performing the appraisal must be certified in Alaska. So that may or may not be the controlling person sitting in an office in another state. However, should things go awry, should things need management's involvement, the board has stated that it's important to them because of Alaska's unique geography, multiple areas of differences that might affect home construction and valuation in the state, that the person who has that contracting management authority be licensed, certified in Alaska. Fortunately, the federal government, we don't see this a lot in federal government, they've made it easier to be licensed in multiple states through reciprocity guarantees or make it more fluid for appraisers to be to be registered in multiple states. So should this amendment be adopted and this bill pass, we would expect it wouldn't change anything for the boots on the ground appraiser, but would give the controlling person more Alaska information. It would not be difficult for them to become licensed in Alaska, and might be a benefit to the appraisal in the state.
Okay, thank you. And not knowing much about this industry, would we anticipate a large number of individuals wanting licensure by reciprocity if this bill passes with this amendment?
Mr. Chairman, I believe we've estimated about 200 AMCs, so we would expect the controlling person of each of those, should they all want to do business in Alaska, which we hope they would seek licensure or certification in the state to meet that requirement. And through the resources in the fiscal note and the board's support for this bill, we would do everything that we could to make sure that happens efficiently and effectively.
Thank you. Any other questions from Ms. Chambers? Thank you. And I would like to hear from the bill sponsor, Ms. Mortage. And for the record.
Thank you, Chair Quito. For the record, Edra Morledge, staff to Senator Meyer, the sponsor. With all due respect, the sponsor is not supportive of the amendment. There was not a compelling reason that we could find in our research to require the controlling person to be certified in each state that they have that an AMC operates in. I found that to be an additional economic burden and just a cumbersome process to maintain certification when they're generally not the person with the boots on the ground performing the actual appraisal. If you'd like a little bit more background from the professional trade organization, Mark Schiffman is very good at sort of explaining the reasons for why 44 out of the 46 other states don't have that requirement.
Thank you. Any questions for bill sponsor? With that, I will maintain my objection on amendment number one. So can we call the roll, please?
Representative Stute?
Yes.
Representative Josephson?
Yes.
Representative Wolf?
No.
Representative Birch?
No.
Representative Knopf?
Yes.
Representative Sullivan Leonard?
No.
Chair Quito?
No.
Three A's, four nays.
So three A's, four nays. Amendment number one has failed to pass. Do you have another amendment, Representative Josephson?
I move amendment number two.
Okay, amendment number two. I will object for discussion, Representative Josephson.
Chairman Quito, I defer to my staff to present this and explain it.
Okay, Mr. Atkinson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tom Atkinson, staff to Representative Josephson. I believe this is a much less controversial amendment, and I found in via email discussion that I shared with Ms. Mortledge that both Mark Schiffman of Riva and Dave Derry of the Appraiser Board want this amendment. As it reads currently in version R, there's a controlling person would have to meet all three of the definition 17 A, B, and C. That would be difficult, and it would be a strange arrangement to be both the owner and employee. I checked with the appraisal subcommittee. They don't, as Vince pointed out, they don't mention controlling person. So it's totally up to the state to decide what it, to define a controlling person. And it really would be, I believe, an imposition on appraisal management company to meet all three. In the model legislation proffered by the Appraisal Institute, they have or rather than and. So you only need to meet one of those qualifications.
Thank you. Any questions for the amendment sponsor? Response from the bill sponsor?
Thank you. For the record, Edra Morledge, staff to the bill sponsor, Senator Kevin Meyer. We have no opposition to this amendment.
Okay. Thank you. Any discussion on amendment number two? I will remove my objection. Is there any other objection to amendment number two? With that, amendment number two is adopted. Unanimous consent. Representative Justin.
I move amendment number three.
Okay, and I will object for discussion.
And once again, Mr. Chair, I'd invite Mr. Atkinson to explain the purpose of the amendment.
Yeah, okay. Mr. Atkinson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This amendment grew out of interaction with Mr. Derry, who made me privy to a policy circular provided by the appraisal subcommittee, and in it, it was clear that an owner of an AMC, a person who owned more than 10% of an AMC, the feds require that the state does a background check for that person. And again, I got in touch with the appraisal subcommittee and got a written confirmation from them that that is required in statute. Not, it's not sufficient to have it in regulations.
Okay, any questions for the bill sponsor? Actually, questions for the amendment sponsor. Response from the bill, so Representative Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you elaborate what a background investigation is? That your fingerprints, FBI, all that kind of stuff that they tend to do?
Representative Wool, through the chair, that part is not stipulated by the appraisal subcommittee. They leave it to the state to determine what is a sufficient background check.
Follow-up. Ms. Morledge, or did you have a follow-up?
Yes, I do have a follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My follow-up would be, do you know what the state would plan on doing, saying as it's up to the states?
Representative Wolf, through the chair, I believe they'd run the same background check that they run on appraisers.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Ms. Morledge, bill sponsor.
Thank you. Edra Morledge, staff to Senator Meyer, the bill sponsor. We're in support of this amendment as well.
Okay. Thank you. Any other discussion on amendment number three? Seeing none, I'm going to go ahead and remove my objection to amendment number three. Any additional objections? Seeing none, Representative Wool.
Question. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if I heard correctly from Ms. Chambers earlier, let's say there's 200 companies that want to do business in Alaska as AMCs. So that means those 200 people would, of anyone who owned more than 10% of a company, which there's probably more than 200, so say, I don't know how these companies are divided up, but if there's many partners, that means every single one of them would have to submit, say, fingerprints to the state of Alaska before they could practice in this state. Is that correct? So maybe 600, 800 people, something like that.
Mr. Atkinson?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know the answer to that question.
Ms. Chambers?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senator Chambers, Department of Commerce.
Do you need the question repeated?
No, thank you. Right now, for real estate appraisers, we don't have the authority nor need the authority to require fingerprints. We have a less intrusive method of soliciting what we call professional fitness information from appraisers. We would do the same for those controlling persons, those owners of 10% or more of the company. Representative Wool is correct that if there are multiple owners with a share that amount or larger, they would have to also submit an application that where we would vet their moral character and go through the process that has already been approved by the Federal Appraisal Subcommittee.
Thank you. Do you have a follow-up?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wool.
So in your fiscal note that was presented, this additional person you're hiring, if 500 people applied to practice in the state of Alaska, that person would adequately be able to deal with that kind of influx of licensing, application, background check, et cetera?
Through the chair, Representative Will, that's an excellent question. And should this amendment become part of the bill, we may be allocating more of that person's time to this program and thus adding to the cost to the program. But again, that's all recoverable. And the fees we would charge the AMCs in the owner applications.
Okay.
I guess I don't have any more questions. Thank you.
All right. Any other objections? Any other objections to amendment number 3? Representative Wolf.
I do have an objection. Do you want me to speak to it? Or
you don't need to.
Just object.
Okay. So we will do a roll call on amendment number 3.
Yes.
Representative Stutes?
Yes.
Representative Josephson?
Yes.
Representative Wolf?
No.
Representative Birch?
Yes.
Representative Knopf?
Yes.
Chair Keto?
No. So with a vote of 5-2, amendment number 3 has passed House Labor and Commerce. That brings the bill back before us. And do we have any additional discussion or questions about the bill as amended? Representative Stutes.
Thank you. This is a tough one for me because I still am unsure of the purpose of the bill. It sounds like the purpose is to make sure you're getting a good appraisal. Well, as I stated once before, an appraisal that isn't inflated to prevent what happened once before. And I've had personal experience with someone who is getting their certified appraiser license, and that's a pretty onerous process, and I can't believe that somebody would inflate their pricing at the risk of losing their license. So I guess I'm kind of at a loss as the purpose of this, but it clearly is going to increase costs. So I'm having a problem with this particular bill.
Thank you. Any other discussion on Senate Bill 155, Representative Birch?
I speak in support of this proposal. I think we've had good testimony and support, good documentation. It's clear it provides a measure of independence and separation between the lending institution and the individual or entity doing the valuation. So it seems reasonable to me. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Any other comments? Seeing no other comments, Representative Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move SB 155 version 30-LS1295/R as amended be passed from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Do we have an objection to the motion as stated? Seeing none, we'll take a brief at ease to sign our committee report. Thank you. We are back on the record at 4:05 p.m.
I'll do more homework this week.
And we've got two more bills before us, but I am going to take my leave and turn the gavel over to our capable vice chair, Representative Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
We resume the hearing now. We're going to bring up SB 108, Medical Care Licensing Medical Board, presented by Senator Kathy Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm State Senator Kathy Giesel, representing Senate District N, which are House Districts 27 and 28. I am honored to carry Senate Bill 108 on behalf of the State Medical Board at their request. Mr. Chairman, I'm going to take you through a PowerPoint which actually also serves as a sectional analysis, so we can get both things done at once. So this bill has two purposes. First, to streamline physician licensing, and secondly, to address a need for office assistance in physician offices. There are two categories that the bill deals with, the unlicensed assistant in the office and also a new entity, a licensed assistant. So first of all, streamlining medical licensing, physician licensing. The sections 1, 2, 8, 9, and 10 address this subject. The bill will allow the State Medical Board, to delegate through regulation writing to the Executive Secretary the review and license granting of certain physician licenses. And I will add at this point that will also include physician assistant licenses as well. So the process right now, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, is a license application comes in. There's a licensing examiner that looks it over, makes sure all the pieces of paper are there, though actually much of this is done online, but there's some pieces of paper involved, make sure signatures are correct, the criminal background check is complete, etc. When that's done, the executive secretary, of course, kind of looks it over, but then they hold on to these applications until the State Medical Board meets. The State Medical Board meets four times a year. Thus, a backlog has been created because it has to wait until the board meets because the board looks at each application individually. In addition, only about 5 to 10% of the applications that are sent in are complete. Perhaps the handwriting is so bad they can't tell, you know, doctor's handwriting. But regardless, many of these applications are not complete. So again, that adds to the backlog. What the medical board is proposing to do is to delegate to the executive secretary, this is their staff person that is there directing the board's business between board meetings. So after the licensing examiner looks at the licenses, if everything is there, they would send it on to the executive secretary, who again would double check, make sure everything is there, and then at the moment it's a woman, she could approve that license. She could grant that license between board meetings. In addition, she could issue temporary licenses, again, if the requirements are met, or certifications. The bill in these sections spells out the prohibition to this delegated authority. So if there's any abnormalities in these applications, the executive secretary.
Mr. Chairman, may we ask a question as she moves on, or you want her to finish?
That's fine.
Senator, through the chair.
Yep.
So I think my question is, Senator, is if you're – so you kind of delegate an authority to one person to write the licenses. Is that – I guess my question, is that also approval of the license? And I'll follow up with the second question is, why does a process not work where if the board is now the one doing the approving and reviewing the applications, why is it not the secretary's responsibility to have all the information complete and ready for the board when they convene? It seems to me like we're just doing this backwards for convenience. And I say that because it seems like the more eyes you have looking at an issue, the better off you are. And it just seems I might be confused. I might be misunderstanding, but I'm asking you the question. Was it clear as mud?
Representative Knopf, through the chair, Going back to the second number one on the page, it says review applications and grant license. That is what the executive secretary would be doing. If the application is complete, she, at the time, right now, her name is Deborah Stoven, Deborah would grant the physician the license. If the application is not complete, it remains with the licensing examiner until the applicant completes all the aspects of the application. So that streamlines the process in that more and more applications, as they're complete, could be immediately approved by the executive secretary rather than wait for the quarterly, four times a year, board meetings when the board laboriously goes through each application. If there are any applications with disciplinary action in the past or questions on the criminal background check, those will wait and will go to the state medical board for review and adjudication on whether that license should be granted or not.
Okay, thank you.
Moving on to slide two, sections 10 and 11 address the option for yet another person besides the executive secretary to also have the authority to issue temporary licenses. Now, a question arose in another committee. Well, this sounds like, you know, maybe we're getting too many people involved, and is this really safe for even the executive secretary to be doing this? And just for clarity, understand that right now, the executive secretary has the authorization to grant a temporary license. A temporary license is issued to people who perhaps have completed all of their education. Their application is complete, and rather than hold them, it allows the executive secretary to issue this temporary license so that the new physician would be able to begin work, but the license is temporary. They would not get that final license until the board met. This would allow the licensing supervisor to also participate in the issuing of a temporary license. And sections 10 and 11 outline when this could happen and how it would happen. So that's the streamlining of physician licensing. Now, I'm hoping that there'll be folks online that will be able to underscore why this is so important. I'm hoping you'll hear from Fairbanks Memorial Hospital, though he may have had to drop off. They've lost actually three physicians that they had recruited because it took so long for the license to be approved that those physicians actually found jobs out of state. There's also a situation, one particular incident was cited where a WAMI student who had completed their physician training had to wait 8 months to get their license approved. This was an Alaska resident. The application was complete. So there is a backlog that has developed. A lot of the backlog came about because we approved telemedicine about 2 years ago. Maybe you guys remember that that particular bill. That created a deluge of applications because we required that the physician who is out of state doing telemedicine must be licensed in Alaska. So at last report from the division, there were about 290 applications that are in the backlog. Perhaps today you'll get an update on that number, but that's quite a few applications. And if we can scoot that along a bit, it would be helpful for clinics as well as the physicians themselves. I want to also share with you the process outlined in these sections, which again are 1, 2, 8, 9, 10, and 11, is actually a process that is used by the largest professional licensing board in the state of Alaska right now. In fact, that board has been using this procedure for about 15 years and found it to be efficient and very safe. Moving on to subject two, which is assistive personnel in physician offices. So let me give you a little background on this. When you go to visit your doctor's office, there's probably a nice young person that calls your name and takes you back to the examination room. And that young person takes your blood pressure, asks you what medications you're on, why are you here to visit the physician today, reviews your medical history. These folks are medical assistants that are unlicensed people. The medical community began to create this entity of medical assistants back about the mid-90s. But these people are not licensed. And according to the state board's own laws, it is prohibited for a physician to delegate those tasks to an unlicensed person. Consequently, the state medical board is asking that we correct that in this bill. So that's what this bill would do. The bill will allow unlicensed personnel to be delegated routine medical tasks, blood pressures, possibly giving injections. I'm not sure. This is all going to be up to the board, because you see in Section 3, regulations will authorize, first of all, the delegation of certain medical tasks, routine medical tasks, to an unlicensed person. It will specifically prohibit the delegation of pain management or opioid-related activities, and the board in regulation will define what routine medical tasks are. So this will correct a gap in the state medical board's laws. Moving on, there is a second, this is still the unlicensed person. So this will add the medical assistant to the definition of performing delegated routine medical duties, to the exception for practicing medicine. See, right now, taking the blood pressure, figuring out what medicines you're on, that kind of thing, falls under the purview of practicing medicine. This will allow those medical assistants the exemption. In Section 12, adds medical assistant to the list of those that can practice medicine, and Section 14 adds medical assistants to the definition of medical professionals under criminal procedure law.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Representative Jefferson.
Through the chair, Senator, relative to this new classification medical assistant, are we going to now need to ensure that they have specific training and licensure? So it sounds like I like the cleanup idea, but is this going to be a situation where now everyone has to go back to school and cross T's and dot I's so that they can get their sort of certification formalized?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, that's a great question. These medical assistants may be required to have specific coursework. That will be up to the board. Remember that these folks have been, I'm going to use the word practicing, they have been functioning in medical offices now for about two decades. When they began, all that was required was a high school diploma, and they got on-the-job training, how to take a blood pressure, what kinds of questions to ask in a patient interview. Since then, some education programs have been developed, and so there is some education background for these folks, typically charter college-type type programs. We're going to go next into the next level up of medical assistant, Representative Josephson, through the chair, and you're going to see a higher level of education required, which will address the second part of your question.
Okay. Senator, just to clarify, Senator Giesel, this first group of medical assistant currently doesn't need a license. They will not need to have a license in the future, but the physician can now delegate to them to do blood pressure, weigh people, those sort of introductory things that you do when you go to see the doctor, basically.
Mr. Chairman, you are absolutely accurate. Yes.
Got it. Thank you.
So the second category of medical assistant is one that we are proposing would be certified, which is equivalent to licensed. So why do we need this? Well, you may remember back in Senate Bill 74, which was Medicaid reform, and also we had an opioid bill recently. We bolstered the prescription drug monitoring program. So this, just for review, is that database where someone who receives a prescription for an opioid, that prescription is entered into the database. A prescribing physician, nurse practitioner, whatever, goes to that database to see what prescriptions the patient may have already received. Perhaps they were in the emergency room the day before and already got some OxyContin. Here they are again in the office asking for more. It's a safeguard, right? Well, when we passed that bill, we were very specific. Any person accessing the PDMP must have a license. We wanted a high level of credibility and a high level of responsibility so that if they violated the confidentiality of this very sensitive information, there would be a license that could be taken away. Well, the problem is that with medical assistants now in physician offices to replace RNs and LPNs, there are no licensed people in the physician office other than the physician. This issue was brought to my awareness when I went to a hospice forum that was put on by the Cancer Society, and there was a pain management physician there, and there were a couple representatives there as well as myself. In fact, I think it was another person who isn't on this committee. I was going to say it was Representative Birch, but now I'm remembering who it was. But in any case, we were kind of chewed out by the pain doc. I have no one I can delegate this to. I have to stop what I'm doing and go look in the PDMP. You have to fix this. So in speaking with Dr. Jay Butler, state medical officer, and other folks, we talked about how to fix this. And this honestly is the most expeditious way to fix it. And that is to create a medical assistant licensure level. So let's take a look at what that would look like. So a medical assistant who was certified would be required to get extra training and certification. There are at least two bodies, national bodies, which certify these or accredit these training programs. National exams are already present. There are about three or four of them nationally in different types of medical assistant certification that are available for people to take, and our community colleges already run training programs. These certification programs and medical assistants with these certification are recognized in the states that you see up there. I believe also that the state medical board will require for these folks a criminal background check as part of recognizing them with this license. Going on, Section 4 calls out the certification process that the board will define. The board will define the education, the examinations, all of those criteria. Section 5 is a title protection, so it will limit the use of the word certified. If they're not certified, they can't use that term in their title. And Section 13 makes it very clear that certification will be recognized as equivalent to a license.
So, Senator, if I may. This position, this person, this licensure, this certification, is simply to check the PDMP to see if someone has had another prescription, particularly for an opioid, and maybe enters the new data that the doctor may be prescribing more. And in other words, since doctors are too busy to be doing this, in some offices they're the only technically licensed person, you're creating another licensed person in the office that can check this database, for which they will need training, licensure, and background check. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, you are very close to being absolutely correct. There was one slight correction I just want to make. No prescriber enters the data into the PDMP. That data is entered by the pharmacist when they dispense the medication. That was the only slight correction that I would make. But otherwise, you were absolutely correct.
And if I may follow up, basically, this is a task that someone needs a license so that if they don't do it correctly or something like that, the license can be revoked. So that's a penalty. And the physician now would be removing himself or herself from that possible vulnerability by having another licensed person in the chain, or is that the physician is still not that? In other words, the physician's the only licensed person in the office, so then they add a new person, a medical assistant licensed, to do the PDMP work. So if there's a violation now to that license that's on the line as opposed to the physician's license. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, each licensed person stands responsible for their actions under their license as an individual. The main purpose of the certified medical assistant is to streamline the process and productivity in a physician's office where opioids are being prescribed. It is also possible, as the board looks at this entity, that physicians may say, hey, you know, I'd like to ask these people to do a bit more complex activities in my office. So, medical board, would you please expand their scope a bit more? That's completely up to the state medical board, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. Representative Jefferson.
Just so I think my memory from Law School 101 is, yes, the medical assistant's license could be pulled, but I think under something called respondeat superior, the chief, the physician at the top of the totem pole could be held civilly liable. So I suspect that that's still true.
Sure.
So they should hire wisely.
Thank you, Representative Josephson. I defer to your legal knowledge, which I certainly don't have.
Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just trying to get my head around the number, the 290 backlog, 475 a year plus or minus, and the intervening period. Do you know how many are through the chair? Do you know how many are rejected in a year? I mean, if there's 400 or 500 people, I mean, is the board actively? I mean, are they tossing out 20% of the people that apply and say, hey, you're not qualified? I mean, I'm trying to get a risk assessment here, as to, yeah, I mean, if it's been 10 years since they've not certified somebody, then it's probably a pretty low risk. But if 30% of the people that apply to be certified are rejected for one reason or another, then it's pretty high risk. So I just don't have a sense for that. You?
Representative Birch, through the chair. There are three people. Well, there's two certainly here in the room. We have Deputy Commissioner Fred Parody as well as Director Sarah Chambers, who are absolute experts on that subject and possibly could answer the question. And I don't know if Deborah Stovern is on the line. She is the executive secretary for the state medical board, and she can absolutely give you that answer. Yep. I cannot.
Okay. Paulo?
Yep.
With respect to, and I know there's a lot of medical issues in, you know, HIPAA, the health insurance portability, accountability, whatever it is. Anyway, you're supposed to keep all the medical records secret and sacrosanct and boxed up. And so in an office, a medical office clearly has a higher duty and responsibility with respect to medical records and so forth. How does this apply to you've got a bookkeeper. I mean, you got somebody that's taking your insurance forms. So there's people in medical offices that arguably have very close and detailed access to whatever goes on in that office. Does this not propose to certify everybody that works in a medical office, with the physicians and the nurses and a physician's assistant, and this is just one more layer of certification, but that does not include everybody in the office, does it, through the chair?
Representative Birch, through the chair, no, it does not include the bookkeepers.
Okay, great. Okay, thank you.
So, Mr. Chairman, there are three reasons for this bill. Number one, to streamline licensing. Number two, we have to correct the legal gap of routine medical duties being delegated to unlicensed folks in physician offices. I understand that their malpractice carriers have noted this gap in the law and have instructed them to correct it, or their malpractice insurance rates will go up. And lastly, it will really help, especially in offices that prescribe opioids, if there is a licensed or certified medical assistant who is able to assist the physician in accessing the PDMP and possibly doing more complex duties. For example, giving injections, immunizations to children. This is all going to be up to the state medical board. You can see there why there's a couple reasons for the urgent need for this bill, Mr. Chairman. Lastly, this is widely supported. We've had no opposition, Mr. Chairman. And with that, that concludes my presentation of the bill. Happy to take more questions.
Yes, thank you, Senator. And we have people here to testify, and maybe we'll hear from them. I guess the only last question, and you sort of alluded to the fact that I guess some offices have a doctor and medical assistants and not a lot of nurse practitioners or nursing assistants or any kind of other licensed person in between that may have been able to go. I guess using the PDMP, requiring that person to be licensed for just that task alone seems a technicality, and that's the license they would pull if they would, you know, do something improper, which I guess in other aspects of a doctor's office or a medical situation, there's probably other things that someone could do improperly that may have ramifications besides a PDMP. I figured there'd be more licensed people around that would be doing this task. Obviously, the doctors don't want to do it, so they got to hire someone else. And I guess with that, we'll move on. If there's no more questions for the center, we'll move on to some of our invited testimony. And we have in the room Fred Parody, Deputy Commissioner, DCCED.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Fred Parody. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. I thank you for your time this afternoon. I know it's late, so I will be brief. Alaska's demand for health care, first of all, I want to thank Senator Geisel for carrying this important legislation, which we support, and I especially appreciate her, both her commitment to these issues, but most specifically her professional insights into these topics. Alaska's demand for health care professionals continues to increase. In FY17, our division of CVPL processed 22% more medical licenses and 31% more nursing licenses than in 2016, and has already received more this fiscal year to date, 8 months in, than we did in all of last year. To address this continuing issue, we at DCCED initiated a strategic planning initiative to streamline our application process for medical and nursing applications, which we identified as the number one priority of our department. That initiative included a comprehensive examination of the application process by a team of our employees who actually work day to day with all these issues. I'm quite proud of their work. You've seen it attached where they did the classic whiteboard exercise, and they identified what we called rubs, 27 rubs that were slowing the process down. Everything from the details of how there was a requirement for a notary to stamp the photo of an application, which doesn't actually accomplish anything because first of all, notaries are trained not to stamp in that location, but also that just means that the person is in front of them that they're stamping. It doesn't mean that that person is the person who's in the application itself. So we went through with people that are engaged with us on a day-to-day basis at a very fine-grained level to identify the issues that we needed to address. And we then evaluated the cause of each of those rubs, each of those problems, to determine whether it served a public safety purpose, whether it met or whether it was just a process that was outdated or even obsolete or could be simplified. We initiated a three-prong approach to deal with those rubs. We had three buckets. One was board regulations. Can we simply revise regulations through a regulations project and clean that up? Can we do improvements in our IT process, which I'm happy to report we have worked long and hard at, such that you heard testimony from Senator Geisel to the effect that something well less than, I started to say less than 100%, but actually only 10% or so of these applications are complete when they come in the door. So our IT solution proposes two fixes for that. One is to take it all in online instead of by mail and set it up like the PFD so you can't go to the next question without having answering the question at hand. And the second was the idea of a domino pizza tracker kind of thing where somebody could electronically check the status of their application and see its progress as we move towards completing it. That work is coming to a head. We had a live demonstration of that in the last 2 weeks, and we're preparing to go live with it within the next month or so. And the third bucket was changes in statute, which is what's before you in this bill and is why we support it. So with that, I want to express our support for the bill. I am unable to answer Mr. Chairman, Representative Birch's question, but I'm confident that the Executive Director, Deborah Stovern, can either on the phone today or subsequently in the near future.
Thank you, Mr. Parody. We have a question from Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, through the chair. Hi, Mr. Parody. Just a quick question, if you don't mind. I've listened to this bill in the HES committee, and it's here today. And just looking at ways to streamline the process, as we're looking at, for example, certifications for a medical assistant, if they are taking classes, for example, at Charter College, could they then also have their licensure be invoked at or applied at that time? So that way, when they're coming out of their colleges, they're ready to go. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, Madam Representative, I have not heard that suggestion before. It's of interest to me, and I'd have to look into it. Sarah may have a, Deputy Director Chambers may have a better answer.
Thank you. Just to follow up, Mr. Chair. I guess my hesitation in full support at this time is part of that. And, you know, as we are looking at providing a support network for the physicians in their offices, if they're hiring medical assistants and then they have to pause and make sure they're taking all of these classes to make sure they get their licensure, I'm just wondering if we're doing double duty or if maybe we could do it all at the beginning stage of when they're going through their courses.
Mr. Chairman, it would certainly seem to me, Representative Sullivan Leonard, that the school would be quite a logical location to walk the student online and into the online process now that we're achieving an online process in particular.
Okay, thank you.
I have a question. I'm not sure if you're the appropriate answer, but I'll throw it out there. So if the board would have this new executive secretary being able to give out licenses, is that right now one of the boards, would that be sort of abdicating one of their responsibilities to someone else? In other words, is that sort of a statutory responsibility of the board to delegate, to issue licenses, and only the board can do that? And if an executive secretary can, would that then be removing that responsibility from the board, or I guess they would?
Mr. Chairman, I think that question's better answered by either the sponsor or Deborah Stovern, but I would say that I don't believe that expanded authority. It's not unlimited authority. It's authority that's commonly delegated in other board situations, and I think it recognizes both the limited board meeting schedule and the ability to address what are problem-free applications.
Okay. Thank you. And maybe with that, we can go to...
Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Deborah Stovern, who's online from Anchorage, also from the DCCED. If you can hear us, can you introduce yourself and give us your... Oh, you're here for questions, but did you hear the last question?
I did. Thank you. This is Deborah Stovern. For the record, I am with the Department of Commerce, Division of Professional Licensing, and as it has been noted, I am the current Executive Administrator for the State Medical Board. The Executive Secretary is the official title. The question was about whether the board would be abdicating their authority to me or a future executive secretary. And I think it's important to note that what this bill would do is allow the board to specifically delegate that limited authority to the executive secretary to grant license under specific conditions. It would be the board would need to write regulations that specified under what conditions I would be able to grant those licenses, that any application that had derogatory or adverse information or had any questions or concerns would still require the board to review for approval of a temporary or a permanent license. The board currently does delegate the authority to me to grant temporary permits under those kinds of conditions, and that delegation of approval authority currently requires, and I would anticipate would continue to require, a specific delegation by the board on an annual basis.
Okay. Thank you. And there was a question from Representative Birch earlier, and I don't know if you want to rephrase it or if you heard it, Ms. Stovern. I'll let Representative Birch rephrase this question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, I would just, you know, in delegating approval for an interim period, you know, for maybe as long as 3 months, which seems on the face of it fairly reasonable. But I guess it begs a question of how many applicants are rejected, and when you're trying to evaluate the risk. And I, of course, the other aspect of Deputy Commissioner pointed out, there's a move afoot there to get this all automated. So that's probably a heading in the right direction. But do you have a sense as to what's the number? If there's a 290 backlog and 475 a year processed, I mean, is it 5% rejected or denied or turned away, or is it? I mean, I don't have a sense for how many people you don't certify because they didn't meet whatever the minimum qualifications were. I mean, that to me is a measure of risk that's involved here. Through the chair.
So thank you, Representative. Through the chair, the board actually denies only a couple of applications every year at most as an outright denial. There are probably another small handful of applicants that choose not to continue the application process because they don't meet the threshold requirements for licensure. Other applications that have, as I said, derogatory information or adverse information or information of question or concern, the board often asks them under their statutory authority to come in for a full board interview, an in-person interview, so that the applicant is able to explain that information more thoroughly in the board to understand it so that they can make an appropriate decision about whether to license. But actual denials, there are only a handful of those.
Follow up. Well, I wanted to thank you for that, because as somebody that's kind of interested in kind of a risk assessment or risk analysis, it sounds to me like if you've got 400 or 500 of these a year, there's only a handful that are either, you know, pull out or stop their application process. It sounds like a very low risk bet here to accelerate. And I am very familiar with having lived in Fairbanks for 25 years, and very familiar with the folks at the hospital there. I'm very much aware of the challenges faced with, you know, having somebody, you know, having their career basically hung out to dry for 3 or 4 months at a time when they're waiting for something to clear. So I appreciate your efforts and initiative to streamline and get this process on track to give a rapid answer and response. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Joseph. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just I'll be fast because I think there's another bill. But
yes, sir.
I guess for this, Ms. Stovern, is it?
Yes.
When you license someone temporarily or otherwise under the bill, what is it that you're licensing? So, for example, if someone is an orthopedic surgeon and has done an internship, a residency, that sort of thing, notwithstanding the hospital privileges question, what is it that you're granting them? A license that says they are a medical doctor in Alaska and nothing more?
Through the chair, Representative, yes, that is correct. The medical board issues licenses to allopathic and osteopathic physicians, to podiatrists, to physician assistants, and to mobile intensive care paramedics. So, yes, that's what the license would be, is a license to practice medicine in the state of Alaska.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Stovern. We have in the room Jeannie Monk from ASHNA. Do you want to come up and testify?
Good afternoon. I'm Jeannie Monk. I'm with the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association, and I'll be really brief today because I know you have one more bill. I just want to let you know that we strongly support this legislation. We strongly support streamlining the medical licensure process. We hear regularly from hospitals around the state and clinics that the licensing process is so time-consuming that they do lose candidates, and it causes a lot of problems in ensuring access to care. So we think this is a great solution. Very happy to hear of the IT changes. I think that will significantly improve the process also. We are in support of fixing the statutory deficiency to allow physicians to delegate routine tasks. So we appreciate the sponsor bringing this bill forward and are in full support.
I have a question while you're here.
Sure.
The new license that's added,
Certified medical assistant.
Thank you. Yeah. I don't know about hospitals and nursing homes, and as opposed to, say, smaller clinics, and I don't know where your area of expertise is, probably hospital and nursing homes, since you're from Ashland, but and where there are a lot of licensed people around nurses and so on. Do you see any issues with this? In other words, if you a small clinic or something or urgent care type place that doesn't have a nurse, has a medical assistant, now they'd be required to, if they're the need to have someone in the office that's licensed, would that, is that an issue that you foresee?
We have had some concerns about creating a new certified personnel, and is it really necessary? We agree that physicians don't have time to look up things within the PDMP, and that it is really important to have somebody available to do that. I know the State Medical Association had an alternative solution that they had proposed, and we thought that made sense. I don't really, as an alternative to creating a new certified personnel. So we were in support of their recommendation, but I don't have enough information to speak to that. But that concern isn't enough for us to oppose or not support this legislation.
Yeah, and I maybe this is a question later for the bill sponsor, but I was just wondering if someone is in an office as a medical assistant and now they require a license, do they just learn how to use the PDMP and that's it? Or do they have to get a whole new?
You know, I think that will be left to the state medical board, and I think many states do have these certified medical assistants.
Okay. Thank you very much. We'll open public testimony at this point. We've had all our invited testimony, so it's 4:47, opening public testimony. Is there anyone here to publicly testify? Seeing none, I will keep that public testimony open. We will be bringing this bill back. At our forthcoming meeting, I don't know exactly which one, but it will be coming back. So I want to thank the bill presenter for coming in. And I guess the question that I asked the previous testifier about the additional licensure needed, is that a one-off sort of certification, or is it a full-blown, I guess you mentioned that there may be other tasks that this, what's the kind of assistant?
Certified medical assistant.
Certified medical assistant. Yeah, thank you, Senator. The certified medical assistant, that would be required to have a license to do the PDMP work, would that be something, there'd be other skills that that person would need to go to school for if they're right now just a regular medical assistant, or would it just be the certification to do the PDMP with the associated background checks, or do you have the answer to that question, I guess?
Mr. Chairman, medical practices are constantly expanding. We incorporated a PDMP. We required the person looking into it to be licensed. That created the need for this certified medical assistant. I can't predict what more possibly that person could take on in terms of advanced procedures in a medical office, but I'm confident that they will expand. Full disclosure, one of the concerns that has been expressed in other committees is, okay, if this person is going to do additional education, they're going to pay for a national certifying exam, they're going to pay for a licensing fee, they will cost more to hire in a medical office. This is something the physicians will work out. They're very good at managing the finances of their clinics. So it may be that they only hire one or two medical assistants with that certification and otherwise simply have the regular uncertified people. These are all details that the medical profession will work out. I would just emphasize the medical board is extremely scrupulous about what they do. They're extremely careful, and I have great confidence that they will do this all very carefully.
Thank you. Representative Birch.
More of a process question. Since we've kind of talked this over pretty good and, you know, didn't have anybody testifying other than the people who are here in the room, is there any reason we have to hold this? I mean, is there a process reason we have to hold it, or can you just kind of vote on it and be done with it and kick it out the door?
Representative Birch, yeah, there is a process, so.
First hearing, we'll hear the bill.
You have two hearings then?
Well,
I'm just asking.
If it was my committee, which I don't fully chair this committee, I would have more time for people to ask questions, or maybe someone would contact them and say about
Fair enough.
Aspects of the bill. Yeah.
I
do not intend to pass this bill today. So we'll be holding this bill. Thank you. And we'll move along to our next item of business, which is HB 136, Motor Vehicle Dealer Franchises. And we have Representative Klayman to introduce the bill.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Matt Klayman, Alaska State Representative for House District 21 in West Anchorage. I want to thank members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee for hearing House Bill 136 in committee today. The impetus to introduce House Bill 136 stemmed from numerous conversations about the need to statutorily update the franchise agreements between auto dealers and auto manufacturers. Much of the discussion centered around warranty practices and franchise termination. When I first introduced the bill last year, we heard significant pushback from auto manufacturers. With those concerns in mind, my office met with both manufacturers and auto dealers early this year and worked on a revision that is acceptable both to the auto dealers and the manufacturers, and that revision is the version that is in front of you today. This committee substitute of House Bill 136 updates warranty policy to be more consumer-friendly. It provides consumers who live in remote locations, either off the road system or more than 100 miles from a dealer, with a reasonable option for warranty repair coverage. As it stands, customers currently need to pay to get their vehicle to and from an authorized dealer for warranty repairs. With House Bill 136, the manufacturer will be responsible for warranty repairs in the remote location or for shipping the vehicle to and from an authorized location at no cost to the consumer. House Bill 136 also updates the rates that manufacturers pay auto dealers for warranty work. The updated rates may not be less than the rates that the auto dealer charges customers for similar non-warranty retail work. This equalizes the rate for repair work across the board. Finally, House Bill 136 amends statutes concerning terminations and succession of franchises. Manufacturers must have good cause for terminating the franchise and must provide dealers with notice and allow the dealers to attempt to fix areas out of compliance with franchise agreements before terminating a dealer. During the sale of a franchise, a manufacturer must take into consideration whether the potential buyer is an immediate family member, partial owner, or otherwise meets the standard requirements for approving the sale. And with that, I'm going to take a short run through the section summary. There is a section summary in the handout, and I won't go through every piece of that. I would note when you get auto dealers and manufacturers, there's a certain tension between manufacturers having a number of demands and requirements that's related to brand success, and dealers sometimes finding that those demands can be challenging in terms of their local economics and the local realities, and sometimes the manufacturer's demands can be somewhat burdensome on the individual local dealers. And the dealers and manufacturers are also united, and they all want to sell as many cars as they can. They want satisfied consumers. And at the core of this bill is really looking, how do we help consumers and how do we create a stable workplace for folks that work in the automobile dealer and dealing industry, because, of course, we don't have manufacturers in Alaska. But there is a shared interest by the dealers and the manufacturers in success. I'll just touch base on some of the sections in the bill itself. Section 3 provides details about the requirements that a manufacturer must comply with to terminate a franchise. They have 120 days to give notice, in which the dealers have the opportunity to put their dealership back into compliance and keep their franchise or keep the dealership going. It also provides that a dealer may terminate a franchise if they can show that the dealer was systematically engaged in fraud. Section 4 talks about good cause for terminating a dealership and makes it very clear that they can't terminate for factors that are beyond the control of the dealer, including the market conditions and an insufficient supply of new motor vehicles. An example I often give about the supply of vehicles and market conditions. Alaska is a place where two-wheel drive pickups aren't a very strong market, but if you look at manufacturers' expectations in other parts of the country, they may have a lot higher interest in two-wheel drive pickups than four-wheel drive pickups. But dealers will all say it's a lot easier to sell the four-wheel drives in Alaska, and so they want their manufacturers' expectations to reflect that Alaska reality. Section 6 updates and amends the franchise, the manufacturer's requirements, and what happens if a franchise is terminated, and in terms of what the manufacturer must purchase back, both in terms of vehicles, equipment, tools, and things like that. Section 6 establishes, again, that a dealer has an obligation to mitigate damages in the event there is a termination. And Section 7 provides the things that the framework for what the manufacturer must pay back to the dealer in terms of relocation expenses and other things in the event of termination. Section 8 provides a procedure for any proposed transfer of a new motor vehicle dealership. It provides, again, a notice requirement, a time during which the manufacturer provides objections, a time during which the dealer can respond to any objections, and also provides a framework that establishes that family members and people that have a 15% ownership in the dealership have a right to continue with the dealership, and also provides a framework for the price issues if a different person becomes the owner of the dealership. Section 9 provides the factors that a superior court must consider if there's a franchise termination lawsuit. Section 10 establishes the burden of proof that takes place if there's a franchise termination lawsuit. Section 12 is the section that provides a lot of detail about warranty work. There's a framework in Section 4525-200 for the time frame for completing warranty work. The second section, 4525-210, deals with the rates for warranty work, which is actually a very important part of the bill, because in the current scenario, non-warranty retail work typically is paid at a higher rate than warranty work, and that's led to a lot of frustration on the part of dealers in terms of getting warranty work performed, and that ultimately translates to the consumer. Section 4525-220 relates to remote locations and the framework for getting repairs done when a vehicle is remote from the dealer, either off the road system or more than 100 miles from the road system. And Section 4525-230 provides instructions for how dealers should work, or provides what happens with delivery to new motor vehicle dealers and the work that's performed and the amount of time that's allowed for that. Finally, Section 13 provides a list of unfair practices. A lot of these have to do actually with what happens with signs. The signage is a very important part of manufacturers' brand identification, and they often have requirements for dealers to have a certain number of signs. And if a manufacturer changes a brand sign and they ask the dealer to bring that in, that can be an expensive investment for the dealer. The dealer actually wants the brand to do well as well, but if you spend a lot of money on big signs and then there's a termination of the franchise, that creates all kinds of problems in the dealer-manufacturer relationship. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'm more than happy to answer questions. I don't want to go into any more detail than that on the section analysis unless members of the committee have more detailed questions.
Representative Jefferson.
Well, first, through the chair, a comment and salute to the sponsor, because you began, Representative Clayman, by saying that this was, I'll paraphrase and use the word, sort of a compromise, and I didn't think that was possible. And we had a bill, Mr. Chairman, I think in my first term, involving not exactly cars and trucks, but sort of Kubota, heavy equipment kinds of things, but with identical problems or legal issues. And so I guess my first question to the sponsor is, are you serious that this is really an agreement between these two sides?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I believe Gary Sleeper is here as an attorney representing the dealers, and I believe what you will discover is that the dealers will tell you all the things they like about the bill and the manufacturers will have no objection.
And with that, Representative Clement, we have invited testimony and people. We're just about out of time, so I'd like to get that going if we can. So we have Gary Sleeper and Steve Allwine, whoever needs to be here, heard. Yeah, we can go a few minutes past five, but not too much longer. So I'm sorry we took longer on the other bills, but that's how we roll sometimes. That was a car joke.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Gary Sleeper, and I'm the attorney for the Alaska Automobile Dealers Association. I, too, would like to thank the committee for giving me the opportunity to testify today in support of HB 136. I would also like to offer my sincere thanks to Representative Kleiman for working with both the dealers and the automobile manufacturers in crafting 136. Due to Representative Kleiman's tireless efforts, and I should add his skills as a mediator, the final bill is supported by the automobile dealers, is not opposed by the manufacturers, which is the best you can hope for in an auto franchise bill, and adds valuable new consumer protections as well. Now, as I think many of you know, the Dealers Association has been working on this franchise legislation for quite some time. During the course of the project, we've been asked on occasion why the legislature should become involved in the contractual relationship between dealers and the auto manufacturers. Why should this legislature get involved? Given the spirit of cooperation that we have recently enjoyed in working with the automobile manufacturers, I don't want to speak unkindly about the manufacturers, but I do want to note that dealer franchise agreements are not negotiated agreements. They are presented to dealers on a take-it-or-leave-it basis, and they may be amended or replaced by the manufacturer without the consent of the dealer. As a result, automobile dealer franchise agreements contain provisions which you would never find in an agreement if the parties had equal bargaining power. For example, a manufacturer may require that a dealer spend tens or even hundreds of thousands of dollars remodeling the dealership, even though the dealer does not want to remodel or simply can't afford to remodel. Manufacturers require that dealers perform warranty repairs on the products that the manufacturers produce to fix manufacturing defects, but only pay dealers 70% or less than what retail customers pay for similar service. This cost is ultimately borne by consumers. Manufacturers may terminate a dealer's franchise for failing to meet sales or other performance goals, regardless of the reason why the dealer failed to meet these goals, such as having to compete or conduct business in a weak local economy, like we're seeing in some cities in Anchorage or Alaska, or because the manufacturer failed to provide the dealer with an adequate supply of desirable vehicles, as Representative Clayman just mentioned. And manufacturers may refuse to pay dealers for the cost of repairing defects which are discovered by the dealer in the course of performing another warranty repair. Let me mention what this means. It means that if a consumer brings a car in for a warranty repair and while performing the repair the mechanic discovers another unrelated problem, the manufacturer will not reimburse the dealer for performing this repair. This can lead to delay in getting the repairs done because they may need to get manufacturer approval while the consumer waits, and substantial inconvenience to the consumer because the consumer may have to bring the vehicle back for another visit to the repair store or shop. So all 50 states, including Alaska, have adopted franchise laws which are designed to help level what can be a very imbalanced playing field. In addition, franchise statutes contain provisions which benefit consumers as well. Here in Alaska, the law governing automobile franchises was adopted in 2002 and has not been amended in the 16 years since. The Alaska Franchise Act, when it was adopted, and it was a bare-bones franchise law and does not provide many of the dealer and consumer protections available in other jurisdictions. HB 136 is intended to remedy this problem. Now, in the interest of time, I'm not going to go through a section-by-section analysis. I do have a couple of sections that I would like to highlight. And I will skip through a couple of these and probably go to Section 12, which I think really is a very important section of the bill. Among other things, it provides that manufacturers must pay dealers the same amount for warranty work as the amount paid by consumers for similar warranty work. To reiterate,
when a consumer brings a car into a dealer for service and repairs, they pay a certain rate. When the manufacturers have those same repairs done, they pay the dealer 70%. They currently pay the dealer 70% of that rate. Section 12 remedies that and says manufacturers have to pay the same rates as paid by consumers for similar non-warranty work. The section also contains two important consumer protection provisions. The first provides that a manufacturer may not deny a claim for warranty work to repair a problem which is found during the course of performing other repairs. This is intended to address the problem I mentioned earlier, where manufacturers may decline to pay for a repair which is not initially requested by the customer. This will help reduce unnecessary delays in completing service work and will reduce the need for repeat visits to the dealership. The second provision deals with a problem which is somewhat unique to Alaska, and Representative Klayman mentioned this. As you know, many locations in Alaska do not have automobile dealerships with factory-authorized service centers. So, for example, if a Volvo breaks down in Fairbanks, the vehicle must be shipped to Anchorage for repairs. After the repairs are performed, the customer is responsible for the cost of getting the car back to Fairbanks. The situation is only worse if the vehicle is in Kodiak or Sitka or anywhere off the road system. This leads to extended delays in getting repairs performed and significant cost to consumers. I'm pleased to say that with Representative Klayman's assistance and through the joint efforts of the Dealers Association and the automobile manufacturers, the proposed Section 4525.220 goes a long way in resolving this problem. Under the proposed amendment, if a vehicle breaks down in a remote location, the manufacturer of the vehicle is required to make reasonable efforts to have the vehicle repaired in the remote location. So if it can reasonably be done, the manufacturer right now has no requirement to do anything. The consumer, if they want their vehicle repaired, has to get it to the repair station, although the manufacturer will pay the cost of that. If the repairs under this bill cannot be made remotely, the manufacturer must ship the vehicle to a qualified repair facility and then return the vehicle to the remote location at no cost to the consumer. Under current law, the manufacturer will bring the car, say, from Fairbanks to Anchorage or from maybe Kodiak to wherever it gets repaired, but the consumer is responsible for paying the cost of getting the vehicle back. This bill changes that. We believe this proposed amendment represents a major step forward in protecting Alaska consumers from unreasonable delays in getting their cars fixed under warranty and will also save consumers thousands of dollars in transportation and other costs. Again, I'm not going to discuss Section 13 in the interest of moving things along. Let me conclude by saying HB 136 is a result of extensive negotiations between the dealers and the manufacturers, including a day-long mediation that was hosted by Representative Klayman. Neither party, and I think Representative Josephson commented on this, neither party got all of what it wanted by any means. But the final product provides benefit to dealers, to manufacturers, and to consumers as well. And with that, I'm happy to take any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Sleeper. Any questions? Seeing none.
Well, just a quick comment.
Representative Josephson?
Honestly, Representative Klayman didn't ask me to say this, but when we left Juneau, I recall, I don't remember the season because we were here so long, but I recall him saying, I'm going to work on this, and I'm going to bring these parties together and reach a settlement. And I'm very impressed. And I was not told to say that.
If I may comment, just to follow up on that, I'm also incredibly impressed. I took to having to carry my cell phone around with me all the time. Weekends, evenings, you name it, and I would get a call from Representative Klayman who would say, all right, the manufacturers are dealing with it in this way. What do you say about this and what do you say about that? And I hung up the phone and I said to my wife, does Representative Klayman ever stop working? But he really did work hard to do this. And I can tell you the Dealers Association appreciates it very much and strongly supports HB 136.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
We have Steve Allwine here as well. We're just about out of time.
Mr. Chairman, if it's okay, I'll just defer.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. I will open public testimony, so we'll be open next time. It's 5:10 p.m., and I'll leave public testimony open, and we'll hold this bill over. And our next meeting, which will be on April 4th, Wednesday, we'll do HB 230, Telecommunications Internet Privacy, HB 264, shopping bag fees and recycling, HB 262, Military Spouse Courtesy License, and SB 125, Extend Bond Authority for Interior Energy Project. And with that, I will adjourn this meeting at 5:10 p.m.